Ken, what is the MAPS program? What does that stand for?
MAPS stands for Monitoring Avian Productivity and Survivorship. It is a continent-wide monitoring protocol. Began in North America in the mid-90s, was developed by a not-for-profit group out of California called the Institute for Bird Populations. It began as a core in California and gradually spread through the continent. Right now, there's about 1,000 stations located, as I say, across the Canadian and U.S. continent. And these are operated typically by small organizations and groups who then submit the data to the Institute for Bird Populations. And the analyses of these data go towards understanding the population trends of North American songbirds and looking at the reasons by which these songbirds are in population decline predominantly across all species. Up in the Fort McMurray region, we have adopted this protocol with an intent of using it to evaluate not only populations and our contribution here to the continental effort, but specifically to look at how songbirds and their cousins, the woodpeckers and some of the other land birds, are colonizing and using reclaimed areas in comparison to their colonization and use of natural areas. And these data then feed into the industrial effort to reclaim and improve reclamation practices.
And how big is the area that you're monitoring?
We're working from areas south of Fort McMurray, as far south as Conklin, and as far north, well north of Fort Mackay, and over to Curl Lake to the northeast. It's about 250 kilometers on a north-south axis and about 70 kilometers east-west.
And you have a number of different companies that are actually supporting this, don't you?
Yes. There's a consortium of 10 companies currently supporting the MAPS program, one of which is Syncrude, who has placed 8 of these MAPS stations within and around their project area. These 8 stations are a subset of the larger regional program, which includes 38 stations, of which 33 are in operation this year.
Now, the last time we spoke was in 2014, and at that point you had 2 years under your belt and you were banding a number of different birds. How have things progressed since then over the next 2 years?
It's been an incredibly successful program. As you know and mentioned, this is a bird banding program, so we uniquely mark individual birds that are captured according to provincial, national, and international standards. These birds, as I say, are banded and released back into the environment, and we look for recaptures of these birds both within the season they're banded and in future seasons. Back in, I guess it was about 2014, we had banded somewhere in the vicinity of 5,000 birds, and we're now up into nearly 30,000 bird captures of almost 90 species.
So 30,000 birds, what are you finding? Are some of these birds coming back?
We get somewhere in the vicinity of 5 to 10% of the birds we band come back. Most of them come back to nearly the exact same location where they were originally captured and banded. Almost all of the birds we catch are migratory, and they migrate anywhere from the southern U.S. to as far south as southern South America. So their journey is pretty interesting. They'll travel down, as I say, to the southern reaches and then return almost to the same location next season or a couple seasons into the future.
Now, you said that there's about 90 species that you've been banding. What would some of those species be? Are they all the little dicky birds, or are you counting ducks and that sort of thing as well?
Our target species are what we call land birds. So these are species that nest on the land and near ground level. Our nets only stretch so high, they're less than 3 meters tall. And so we're focused on the birds that use predominantly these habitats for nesting and foraging. We do not target ducks and larger birds. Game birds and waterfowl are not part of our target. So occasionally one of these birds, particularly when they're younger, will find their way into the net. Those ones we capture data on but do not band unless we have the proper permits and band sizes. So of the 90 species I mentioned, they would be warblers, sparrows, woodpeckers, chickadees. Those would be the majority of the catches.
So what kinds of things are you finding out about these birds?
I think the biggest finding so far on the population side is that these species have a natural cycle of abundance. And so in the early days of the MAPS program, 2011, 2012, we had fairly high capture numbers, particularly of a few species of warbler, Tennessee warbler, and sparrows, such as the white-throated sparrow. And that in that time, the number of captures has decreased until 2015, when we saw an uptick in bird numbers again. This would be a continental scale population cycle, not something driven by Fort McMurray habitats or boreal forest habitats, but indicative of a broader population cycle.
Now, what causes these cycles?
That's a good question. It's hard to say exactly, you know, what's driving the cycle as we see it here in Fort McMurray, but these birds do undergo normal oscillations in populations, can be driven by food and abundance of food. So up in this area, we have routine or cyclical infestations of caterpillars, spruce budworm and tent caterpillar, and the birds are keyed into that. We haven't had an infestation and outbreak of those species, those caterpillar species, since the late 2000s. And it's possible that we're seeing a population decrease in this region because of a change in food abundance. There's also climactic cycles such as El Nino and its cousin La Nina, and birds are quite responsive to that. And it may be that they're responsive to the weather that comes from these cycles, or they're responsive to changes in insect abundance, which themselves are reactive to climactic variability.
Are you able to draw any conclusions about the Fort McMurray habitat, changes in habitat there, and how that might impact birds?
So within our objectives, we're looking specifically at how the birds are responding to the reclamation areas and habitat development in these reclaimed areas, as well as how birds are using habitats near disturbances, so noise or highway disturbances and the like. On the reclamation side, I think there's two findings that are starting to become apparent. The first is that as the habitat grows and becomes structurally complex, which would include ground cover, short shrubs, taller shrubs, and eventually a tree canopy, we're seeing the birds move in and take advantage of these created habitats. And that the greater the complexity of the habitat, the more diversity of birds and more use of that habitat that those birds make of it. The second finding that seems to be coming apparent is that as the habitat develops, we can expect certain species to move in. So in the early stages, when tree planting has just been completed and the habitat is fairly short, you will see the ground species coming in, which are predominantly sparrows. They like to live along the ground, and they find this habitat to be suitable. As the trees grow and the understory, the shrubs and ground cover develops, we see additional species groups moving in, the warblers, the thrushes, vireos, and so on. Habitat complexity is important for these birds. And secondly, if you have that complex habitat, we see what we would consider to be a relatively natural succession of bird species colonizing and using the habitat.
So what happens now? Is there an end to this project, or is it a continuing project?
At this moment, it is a continuing project. Every year we sit down with our sponsors and look at not only what have we found and what have we learned, but what the future looks like. And at present, we're continuing to plan towards a 2017 and beyond program.
So are there some things that you would like to do that you've outlined so far for the next 2 or 3 years?
Looking ahead, I think the most important thing from our perspective is to continue the data record. We have 38 stations in the program. As I said earlier, 33 are currently operational. We had some constraints this year due to forest fire. And we believe that continuing this program And as I say, continuing the data record will allow us to evaluate whether the cycle in populations is, as we expect, likely to continue with a return of higher numbers of birds in our various stations. We also would like to track the ongoing colonization and use of reclaimed habitats. It's the early years of habitat development that are really important to monitor.
Why is that?
It's important for a couple of reasons. One, this is the time, the very early stages of reclamation, when you would expect to see the colonization by certain species, as I said earlier, the sparrows, and being able to monitor their colonization use and then transition into more complex habitat with greater species is very educational for everyone involved, including the companies, as to whether that reclamation area is beginning its succession on the path that it's intended. And so it gives early insight into how that habitat will grow. The other reason is these habitats are reclaimed and contributory to the broader populations of songbirds. And as long as we have a functioning habitat and birds are breeding in these habitats and contributing young back into the population, then we know that there's significant contribution of the habitat back into the natural ecology of the species using it.
Now, you mentioned the forest fire. What impact has that had that you've seen so far? How did that affect you?
That's a very interesting question, and I think I can answer how it's affecting us in terms of being able to run the program. It's a bit harder to elucidate at this point how it's affecting the birds. With 33 stations operational this year, we found a lot of support from our sponsors in getting us back into the region after the evacuation and getting us into the sites to get them up and running, which was a significant effort by all involved. Three of our monitoring stations experienced some level of fire. One burned very hard. Most of the trees and undergrowth have been killed. And again, this is a natural part of the boreal forest ecology, so it's not that these areas have been lost per se. They're just changed and reset back to time zero. One of our stations burned mostly at ground level, so the understory is gone, but the canopy is recovering. And then the third station, some of it was burned hard and some of it was burned not at all, and a bunch of patches in between. So we're very fortunate in the way that we now have a time zero for three of our stations, and we can now begin to watch the natural succession of birds and their use of these naturally recovering habitats.
What is it that you actually have at these birding stations?
The MAPS program is, as a mark recapture program, involves the capture of the birds and banding them with a uniquely numbered leg band. And this is all coordinated through the Canadian Wildlife Service in Canada. The birds are captured using what's called a mist net. It's a 12 meter long by 2.5 meter tall net. The birds, as they go about their daily life, will fly into the net. Our bird banders make regular routine visits of the net during a morning of banding, extract the birds, take them to a small, basically tarp on the ground banding station, and apply the leg band. Also look at the bird for its health status and do some basic measurements. These stations are run, each of them, 6 times per year, focused in on the breeding season, which is from about mid-June to mid-August. The MAPS program focuses in on the breeding season, which is from mid-June to mid-August. It's a defined 60-day period. Within that 60 days, each of the stations is monitored 6 times, once in every 10-day period. We have a team of 2 that goes out and sets up these mist nets for the morning of banding, operates the station for 6 hours, starting at dawn, and captures, bands the birds through that period. At the end of that period, the nets are packed up and carried back out and used on the next day of monitoring.
So when the fire burned through and it hit some of those stations, did you lose any data, or is the data all collected manually?
It's very much a manual process. The MAPS protocol has some flexibility that allows for situations like what occurred with the regional forest fires this year. Most field programs have associated with their protocols adjustments that can be made, because working in the environment outside is always subject to weather and other pressures such as forest fires, and this protocol is adaptable in that sense. What we experienced this year was a later start to the program, which is permitted in the protocol, and we lost a little bit, or didn't collect, it's not that we lost, we didn't collect data from the first few days of that 60-day period that I mentioned earlier. Most of our field teams were able to get out and conduct their monitoring early enough that the entire season was preserved. So our companies and sponsors worked really hard with us to allow us access into these areas through their fence lines, and supported us as we rolled out the program in what was a very compressed time this year relative to both what we planned and how it's run in previous years. We didn't lose any equipment, and we didn't really lose anything other than just a shortened data collection period, which again, the program allows for, and the statistics behind the program can accommodate.
During the fire, like, what happens to the birds? Do they fly away?
Yeah, good question. In 2011, when this program initiated, we were just south of the area burned in the massive Richardson fire. It was a fire of almost equal area extent, and we captured a fairly high number of birds that year. Our initial presumption was that we were at a peak in the population cycles of the birds, but it is possible that we were seeing something called habitat crowding. This is where habitat nearby becomes unavailable for the birds, and they move next door to an area where the habitat is more suitable, and you have essentially a larger number of birds crowded into a smaller area. So that may in some ways explain the 2011 data. We were hypothesizing that this year we would see much the same effect, where areas that were burned, we would find fewer birds, and areas that were unburned. And this fire did leave a real patchwork of habitat, where some areas are burned very hard and other areas are untouched. And we were thinking that in those untouched areas, we would see habitat crowding and a large number of birds. Initial indications this year are that we're not seeing habitat crowding in our monitoring stations, many of which, the majority of which, are contained within what is drawn as the fire line for this particular fire event. So our thinking is that perhaps the smoke, or perhaps the presence of fire in the region, deflected these birds away, and that somewhere outside that fire perimeter line, these birds have found a place to nest this year. So really, in order to interpret where the birds have gone and what the effect of the fire this year will be on them locally, we're going to have to wait until next year or the year after to see what patterns of bird abundances and species diversity occurs in the area.
So really, that fire occurred right when the migration would have been really underway.
Correct. It was when the birds were coming in and beginning to settle into their territories, and the males were starting to define their territories and defending them, trying to attract a female. So it would have been pretty disruptive for those birds.
It will be really interesting to see what your data says next year.
Exactly. We're pretty excited about that opportunity.
Now, you've been using some pretty fancy technology to capture bird sounds and that sort of thing. I believe it's called ARU. What does ARU stand for?
It stands for Automated Recording Unit. Others call it Autonomous Recording Unit. Same thing. These are electronic devices to which acoustic, so sounds you and I hear, and ultrasonic, sounds that are above our hearing, microphones are attached, and it allows us to record the calls and songs of a wide diversity of species.
And what do they look like?
They look like a little green box attached to a pole, and they're powered by solar power, and there's just a couple of microphones stuck onto the sides of them. They can be attached to a tree. They're very flexible. We use an aluminum pole. It allows us to install the box mounted in a way that makes it easy to connect the power couplings. It puts the ultrasonic mic up high, which is important because that microphone is the one collecting bat calls. And it puts the acoustic microphone, the one that's recording bird and amphibian calls, down low, like where those critters live.
And how do you analyze all of that?
Yeah, the benefits to this equipment is that it allows you to concurrently record all of the calls of these different species groups over targeted period times when we know these species are active. And it allows you to do so in a very remote way. These things just function through the season and collect the data. We download the data at intervals. It does take a fair amount of effort over the post-collection season. So in the fall and winter, we have technicians analyze the data, and it depends on which of the species groups we're analyzing as to how that analysis proceeds. The bird and amphibian calls, our technicians listen and look at the sonograms, the pictorial representation of those calls on a computer screen, and go through each of the files and identifies which species of frog or toad or bird is calling. And we have a separate software package that's used to analyze which of the seven bat species that are present in this region were detected by the microphone.
So now that you have this new electronic recording, so the ARU program, how does that work together with the MAPS program?
The MAPS program is a very intensive monitoring program. It essentially measures bird habitat use by a diversity of birds over an area of up to 20 hectares. Reclamation areas are and are going to be much larger than that and probably beyond the ability for the intensive MAPS program to evaluate fully. At present, Syncrude is co-locating the ARUs with our MAPS station, so the two programs are running concurrently in the same place, and we're looking at the data in a way that allows us to correlate what one program finds with what data the other one is finding. And our expectation is that once we have that correlation, the ARU technology will allow us to reach out further across the landscape than can the MAPS program. And so on a broader reclamation context, these two technologies together will be able to provide fairly robust data set on habitat quality in reclaimed areas.
So, Ken, what are you finding through the use of this ARU technology?
We're finding that it supports and complements the MAPS program very nicely on the bird side. Because it's there all day and is programmed to collect multiple recordings through the day and into the evening hours, we're finding some species are present in habitats, both natural and reclaimed, that we don't detect during the MAPS program. So complementary data sets are always nice and allows us to evaluate the habitat more fully. The ARUs also extend our reach in that we're able to evaluate the presence and relative abundance of two species of frogs and Canadian toad, as well as bats that are foraging over the ARU area. We're seeing a broader distribution of Canadian toad than perhaps we expected. As a result, these toads call infrequently and for short periods of time during the breeding season. The ARUs allow us to detect that. And the bats are showing up and feeding over even the earliest reclaimed areas, which would be indicative of insect abundances that are sufficient to attract bats and have them stick around to forage. So that would be an indirect indication of developing habitat quality as the insect populations also colonize and are using reclaimed areas.
So it's actually quite encouraging news.
It is. We're finding that it is hard to keep biology out, and these organisms are adapted to changing environments and are quite happy in many cases to come and find a niche to occupy 1 year after tree planting in a reclaimed area.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's been great catching up with you.